Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Episode 22, Yo Comments All Whack.
This Week in Law is brought to you by Audible. For your free audiobook, visit audiblepodcast.com/TWiL. And by GoToMeeting. For a month of unlimited online meetings, absolutely free, go to GoToMeeting.com/TWiL. We'd like to thank Victor Cajau for help with this podcast. You can listen to Victor's own podcast, The Typical Mac User, at TypicalMacUser.com.
Yay, okay, well, I've got three of you on, and then Ernie Svensson mysteriously went offline, so I don't think that's anything I can do anything about. Hopefully he will join us momentarily. So, Jason, I've got you on with Evan Brown and Colette Vogel.
Hey, guys, how you doing?
Hey, Jason, good.
So, Jason, I know Ernie and I were just watching you on with Kevin Pollack.
Yeah.
That looked exciting. Is he going to be doing a show on your Ustream channel, or how is that all going to work?
We'll probably make one for him. He's a friend of mine. We play poker together and became friendly over the last year or so. And I showed him Twitter the other day, and he got really into it. And he's got over 100,000 people now, and he really likes the internet, and he's into it. And so he was like, I want to do like a show on the web. And I was like, okay, well, let me show you how it works. And I showed him.
Hey, I'm going to answer Ernie. He's trying to call in. Yay. I have all four of you on the line at the same time.
Right on.
Beautiful.
It's a brilliant thing.
I didn't say anything.
So, yes. So Jason's going to do this show, or I'm sorry, Kevin's going to do this show once a week.
Yeah. I think he's going to do it Sundays, and he's got all these friends in high places. So he's like, you know, emailing, you know, Tom Cruise and the guy who wrote The Usual Suspects, and, you know, just he knows all these big people. So I think he'll wind up getting a lot of interesting people and,
absolutely,
you know, interview them. And it'll be like sort of a Charlie Rose type thing. And the good news is he's just doing it for fun. So the expectation is really low. And we're figuring out the whole, I mean, watching Leo Laporte on This Week in Tech, he's really started to pioneer and figure out how to do this stuff. So we got the TriCaster, which I guess is the device he uses, which is really cool. Let's just switch between videos. And we're going to try some of the different stuff he's been doing and see if it works.
That's fun. I've been recording, and at some point we'll just go ahead and say we've gone ahead and started This Week in Law with Jason Calacanis, who has been talking about Kevin Pollack's new show, and Ernie Svensson and Evan Brown and Colette Vogel. Thank you all so much for being here.
Good to be here.
Great to be here, Denise.
So, Jason, there are, you know, obviously a ton of things I would love to discuss with you, but something that I haven't yet heard someone go deep with you on is the great post/email send that you did to your list on living in public and the end of empathy.
Yeah, that was, I got a huge response from that one.
Yeah. And it's near and dear to my heart, and I think to the hearts of our listeners, not just as participants on the web, but as people who think a lot about how relationships get managed and how the law is relationship to that, and how the law should or should not be involved when someone crosses the line and, for example, spits at Mike Arrington.
Yeah, it's a, you know, I think we're, as a species, either evolving or devolving due to the technology. You know, everything is got pros and cons. You know, the fact that the four of us or five of us,
yes,
can, you know, have a call and discuss these issues and then share it with the rest of the world. Well, that's wonderful and beautiful and awesome, right? And then the fact is we can put this beautiful, you know, discussion we have out on the web, and, you know, the three people who hate each of us most, who either we laid off or fired or, you know, broke up with or whatever, you know, went wrong in a relationship, you know, years ago, plus four or five people who maybe are mentally not so stable, or it could be a combination of those two groups, will then write, you know, all kinds of insane things underneath this beautiful conversation we've had. And anybody who's been online long enough starts to collect these sort of haters or, you know, weird people. And over time, I think it, even if you're the toughest guy in the world and the, you know, it doesn't get to me, it just becomes psychologically grinding to deal with it over and over again. And you saw in the case of the person who killed themselves after being broken up with on MySpace by the mother from across the street kind of situation. I forgot her name right now, but
the Lori Drew case, I think.
Yeah. In that case, you saw, you know, with a younger person, how damaging it can be. With anybody, it's damaging to just deal with this psychological torture that people put themselves through in this world. And, you know, just got me to thinking, why do we do this to each other? You know, like, how did it get to this? Especially being somebody who, you know, was an early participant in blogging and worked a lot with, you know, had 500 bloggers working for me at the peak of Weblogs Inc. So, you know, I've seen the breakdowns that every blogger inevitably has in terms of burnout. It's usually either burnout or a breakdown, somewhere between the two. And it just got me to wondering, you know, what's happening like evolutionarily to us as individuals?
Yeah, I noticed in the LA Times there was some sort of event where they had scholars and sociologists get together and talk about, and I'm sure this is not, you know, a new thing to think about and talk about, but the way that people treat each other online is different than the way they treat each other in person sometimes. And, you know, I wonder if that is getting better or worse and what we can look forward to in the future. It seemed like from the lengthy and thoughtful post that you wrote, Jason, and I encourage everyone to go check that out if they have not, that you're not terribly optimistic.
Yeah, I mean, I think our species is evolving, and maybe this is just one of those moments in evolution where it's not going so well, you know, and I think just from what I've seen, people's empathy for each other just gets drained when they're online. And so as a, you know, as a society, as individuals, you have to really retrain yourself that the person on the other side is not like an object in a video game, you know, to be stomped on or, you know, destroyed in order to get to the next level. But that's how it feels. And blogging certainly felt that way to me. You know, when you look at tech meme and people wanting to be one of the number one bloggers, which is why I sort of retired from it and went to email, because I was like, this is getting meaningless. Every time I post something, 20 people who want to make a name for themselves just boom, attack me. And their arguments are, and these are, you know, then I meet those people and they're like, oh, well, I actually agree with you. I was just link baiting, you know?
Right.
And I'm like, oh, okay, great. You know, and whatever. At the end of the day, it doesn't really matter all that much, but it just, I think, is indicative of the entirely what's happening, even in Facebook, even in Twitter. You know, these things are all great. They accelerate communication, and that's fantastic. But in that same acceleration, it's like a car with, you know, a bad alignment. You know, going faster doesn't fix the alignment. It actually sends it off the road that much quicker. And that's really my concern is, God, this cannot psychologically be good for people. I know people are not sleeping at night. They've got clenched jaws. They feel this aggressiveness. It's going to take years off people's lives, I think. And, you know, that's something that people all become aware of, I think, at different points in time. Usually it takes, you know, having one of their friends or themselves being attacked in some brutal way. But I think everybody's going to come to the same realization.
And do you think that is prompted? And I'm curious, you know, what Evan and Ernie and Colette think about this, too, because, you know, we're in sort of a different place than you are, Jason, you know, as far as visibility. And I'd say probably most of our listeners are, too. Without the hundreds of thousands of followers on our blogs and on Twitter, but yet visible nonetheless. So I'm wondering if people think that it's a function of time or visibility, and, you know, is this a continuum that it really doesn't matter, because the people who, as you pointed out a few minutes ago, Jason, the people who dislike you the most will find you whether or not you have hundreds of thousands of followers. I personally, for example, have been online since, well, have been sort of online in a public way since 2001 when I started my blog. And I have always marveled at the fact that I've never had a Kathy Sierra type incident. I've never had a moment of fear or stalking or intimidation. And, you know, I knock wood as I say it, I certainly don't want to invite that kind of thing. But my interactions with people have always been positive. And I'm wondering if that's, you know, happenstance or luck, or, you know, just wait and the whole bucket of mire comes down on you at some point. Or maybe it's just, you know, this sensation of being somewhat public, but also flying somewhat under the radar. What do you folks think?
I think the problem has been going on for a long time. I think that we see it in a different way now because the internet has made communication so instantaneous. It has allowed for people to interact who don't necessarily know each other. And, you know, even when people do know each other and have the best of intentions, there's miscommunication. I mean, you see this in short messages, text messages, and that's, you know, maybe one reason why people use emoticons to try to give context to what they're saying. But, you know, as far as the really serious problems where people are just flat out mean and vindictive and vicious, I mean, if you, you know, I think, first of all, I'm going to generalize and I'm going to say I think that the really bad stuff, and I have no proof of this, but I'm going to just go out on a limb and guess, is more likely men than women. And as a man, I know that, you know, sometimes you go into a seedy bathroom and you see what people write as graffiti because they can be anonymous. I mean, to me, that the stuff that's going on the internet is really just that graffiti writ large, and the kind of people who like to say those things just are enthralled with the power that the internet gives them. So I think that it is largely a male problem, and I think it's largely an internet problem, just because of the power that the internet gives to those sorts of people.
If I could jump in, I think that the problem and the kinds of behaviors have existed for many, many, many years, and, you know, going way back forever. I think human nature has always had this side to it. But it kind of dovetailing on what Ernie's saying is that the internet gives people an opportunity to amplify that voice in a way that is good and bad. It's good because it's people are talking about this problem. And you know, in some way, it might bring some change or some norms or some sort of development to how people are in offline life too. But you know, in a lot of ways, yeah, it's not great to have these things amplified and causing people to kill themselves or whatever. I mean, I think we even might have been on your show, Denise, once in the past, kind of made a comparison to that film, Dangerous Liaisons, the story, you know, where the notes are being passed and all these horrible things are happening to people in the medieval ages and or Victorian ages or whenever those, you know, whenever the day was. So the same kind of behavior has existed before, and our voices are so much more amplified. That comes with really positive benefits. Some people who used to be very, who have a soft voice, so to speak, and aren't heard, have a soapbox from which they can now speak and say lots of great things. We can all agree a lot of wonderful things have come from the way people can communicate by the internet. But at the same time, that has to come, unfortunately, with the negatives. And how we mature as this matures, I think, as a communications medium, you know, the link baiting technology will fix that. There will be ways to just get rid of link baiting and comment spam and all that. But
right, Jason, you were presumably moderating your comments before you went to your email list.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, there's all kinds of techniques for moderating this stuff. And, you know, it's I don't mind, you know, like a rough and tumble debate. I kind of like that, as everybody knows. I love debating stuff. And a lot of times, you know, even when I'm sort of debating something passionately, people know I've got that, you know, sort of trademark smirk on where I'm sort of laughing about it. You know, like it's all, obviously what we do is all, you know, we build websites. I mean, let's not take ourselves too seriously. You know, I like the analogy of the bathroom, you know, and the graffiti there, you know, and the good news is you probably only have to spend a few minutes in those type of bathrooms, you know, every month. I think what's starting to happen is that bathroom is becoming, you know, where you sit every day, and you know, the sort of vitriol and tone of it is, I think, starting to turn people off and maybe, you know, dehumanize them. And when it's that sort of greater internet F-word theory where it's like anonymity plus a normal person equals like a really bad person. I don't know if you've ever seen that cartoon. And I think that no matter what the tools are to make you go away, whatever, there's a fundamental human behavior issue at work here. And it's definitely accelerated by the technology. That's not going to go away. I mean, yeah, we had people who were jerks or loudmouths or obnoxious, or we've all said something we regret in our lives before, you know, we were on the internet, before 1990 something. We all had those moments. What happens now is I just think those moments are occurring, you know, every day, all over the place, and they get supercharged because people don't understand tone in email or on IM, and they try to do with them emoticons. But I know almost all the people who I've met, as a matter of fact, all the people I've met who've had some kind of a beef with me online, when I meet them in person, they wind up, you know, having a really nice time talking to me, and we have a great relationship, and some of them become friends. Many of them become friends going forward, and they're just like, I can't believe that we had this whole big fight online. You know, what was that about? You know, they don't even remember. So it is indicative of the medium and its ability to just instantly, you know, in your hottest moment, say something without being able to look the person in the eyes and realize, oh, that's a human, you know, as opposed to an object.
Right.
You see that a lot. You know, there's obviously a lot of lawyers that listen to this show, and litigators, you know, would listen to it too. So this is something that I think lawyers can really identify with. The way that you treat opposing counsel, you know, in letter writing or sending an email, you know, saying bad things, making threats, that the demeanor and the position that you can take in that is a lot different than when you actually meet, you know, in the courtroom. People can
I've had that experience, you know, with lawyers for sure.
Right, right. I mean, clearly it's a human phenomenon, and I think the word magnification has come up a couple times in this. You know, the technology just magnifies this, and, you know, makes anonymity so much easier, so you're less accountable for, you know, what your online persona does to a certain extent. But, you know, really one thing that's important on this is, you know, how I think that the amount of abuse that one gets really depends it's in proportion with how normative somebody tries to be online. I know, you know, Denise, you observed early in the conversation that, you know, Colette and Ernie and you and I don't experience the same amount of, you know, maltreatment, if you will, as what Jason talks about. But I think, you know, that we're pretty a bit more objective, perhaps, in our view of the world, and a bit more measured, perhaps a bit more circumspect than what you are, Jason. So I'm wondering if it's much of a surprise that you do get maybe a disproportionate amount of this kind of stuff.
Yeah, what Leo calls it is we think too much. He has to run all our shows through the dethinkulator until they're listenable. So we're lucky to have Jason on with us to sort of prompt us to more spontaneous utterances, I hope.
I think Evan makes a really great point. And, you know, it's funny because as somebody who does litigate and who's somebody, you know, I've practiced law for 20 years, and before I, you know, showed up on the scene, I would hear the older lawyers talk about how gone were the days of civility. And then, you know, in the time that I've been practicing, we started to pass all these professionalism requirements, basically trying to require people to be nice to each other. And invariably, when you get a bunch of the older lawyers together and they talk about what the real problem is, it seems to me that what they tend to come upon is the idea that there's less of an opportunity for lawyers these days to go to court. You know, like when I first started out, I was clerking for a judge, and it, you know, we had oral arguments all the time. Lawyers were always in there, and you treat people a whole lot differently and this is in an adversarial setting, but you treat them differently when you know you're going to have to walk up and shake their hand or talk to them or appear in front of them in front of a judge. And nowadays, most courts, at least around here, have dispensed with oral argument. Younger lawyers come in. They don't get to see how it is that one, in an adversarial world, learns to be cordial and professional to somebody that you're going to have, you know, an argument with. And it just devolves into backbiting and a lot of pettiness. And you talk to any judge who's been around for a while, and they'll tell you it's gotten worse. And I think that's really the reason why it's gotten worse, is that it's hard for people to learn how to do that when they don't interact face-to-face. And that's the problem with the internet, is that it allows so many interactions to occur so rapidly, and yet it's decreasing the opportunity for people to interact one-to-one as human beings, which goes to what Jason was talking about earlier. When people meet him, they say, hey, you're not so bad.
So how is it, Jason, now that you've moved it to your email list and people are communicating Wonderful. With you one-on-one but not in person? Oh,
so much better. I think there's something about sending somebody an email, as much as people will complain about emails having, less tone, they have more tone than a lot of other things out there on the web. So there's like 13,000 people on this list now, and it only started in August. And, you know, I send an email, and I, like the empathy one, might get 500, 1,500 responses, 500 on the low end, 1,500 on the high end. And some people write me 3, 4, 5 paragraphs. Some write 5, 6 pages. Very heartfelt, very personal. I've read this. I read that. I identify with this piece. I know you from this time. I met you at this conference. Here's what I'm going through in my life. I mean, people tell me extremely personal, private things. And the whole tone of my relationship with the rest of the world from blogging just to emailing has changed tremendously. And so I gave a lot of thought to why that is. And I think what it is people look at me as a human being again.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, as you say, if they're taking 3 or 4 pages and talking about personal things, they're probably putting a lot of thought into it, and they're not able to engage in any kind of link baiting, of course, because none of this is on the public web. So,
yeah, it's not, I mean, and they it's like we get the benefit, myself and the person who, you know, I send the email to and they respond to. The two of us get the benefit of discussing something that is important to both of us, and nobody else gets to be involved in it. Nobody needs to be involved in it because, you know, the two of us may not want that. Just like you think about like some of the great interactions you've had in your life, it might just be two people sitting on a beach having a conversation or sharing a drink at a bar or going to a Knicks game together, whatever it is, you know, those can be extremely special. And I think this whole like public, you know, living in public and everybody being able to look at every moment and analyze it, and then the weird freaks coming to, you know, just spit on it. It you know, literally, figuratively, whatever the case may be, it's just not worth it at a certain point. It's much better to just have a real conversation with a smaller number of people. The laws of big numbers just make you more of an object, and you know, it starts to get into this celebrity, and people keep using this term celebrity. I mean, obviously, I don't think I'm a celebrity, but some people say you're a web celebrity. I don't know what that means, but
right. But certainly living in public, I think, is a very apt term. So oftentimes you'll take one of these sends to your list, the lengthier and thoughtful ones, more often than, say, we're starting a new show kind of thing, although those show up too. And you'll put them on your blog. You'll put them on calicanus.com.
Yeah. I started putting them up there because I get too many emails of people who really are like, oh, where can I get it? So I start putting them up there without the comments turned on. And just like, here it is. You can read it. It's read only, you know, knock yourself out. And I put it out like a little bit later, and I don't make a big deal out of it that I put it on the blog. It's just like there as a reference. But I'm actually thinking I did that a couple of times, and then, you know, that's led to another, you know, I think it just makes it more special if I don't do it. So I'm actually thinking about not doing that now. Mm-hmm. But there's sometimes when I write something that I think can help people, and I'm like, oh, like I wrote this one about what to do if your startup's failing. You know, it's 3,000 or 4,000 words. It's based on a lot of personal experience with different things failing. And so I gave it to Business Week. I was like, can we publish this? It's really important, you know, that people read it. And I was like, okay, if people are going to get value out of it. So I keep going back and forth. I'm torn myself, you know, like, yes, you want to share your ideas, but do you want to share them and then just deal with the fallout from them? It's just like, sometimes it's exhausting, you know, as you can probably hear my voice, like, you know, I get tired. It's just like, oh, you know, so much strife and fighting over, you know, points that if I said them to you in person, you would just say, you know, that's interesting. But online, you know, you're looking for that one point to, you know, create some massive reaction to that you can, or the certain group of people is contingent. Okay, I got to find the weakness in this argument, then crack it, and then come up with a sensational headline, Calacanis is an idiot, you know?
Right.
And that's how I'm going to get to the top of the thing. Or Mike Aaron, you know, Michael Arrington is blank, or, you know, Steve Gilmore is X, and Leo Laporte is Y, and Kevin Rose is this. And, you know, the, just how do I crack one of those top people to get my name out there? And it's just it's become such a formula that there is actually techniques to it. I went to an SEO conference and they're like link baiting 101, and they have literally had a, you know, 2-hour panel discussion about how to do this technique of starting fights with people in order to get inbound links for your site to increase your SEO.
Oh, that's so sad.
It's unbelievable. It's the only thing sadder than that is social media optimization, which is like, you know, people training people how to take their social media presence and use it in order to make money. And it's like, I mean, I know people, like, our existence is we have to make money. That's how we put roofs over our heads and feed our kids. But, you know, to make it into a, to make online social interaction into a science like that is, it feels as distasteful as these, like, books, like How to Pick Up Girls and Score with Girls, you know, like the, you know, like the techniques for, you know, preying on women's insecurities. Or, you know, like this guy wrote this book, Neil Strauss, who I actually know is a really nice guy, but he talks about how to, like, if you want to pick up a model, you know, the way to do it is, like, be like, wow, you've got big ears, you know, like just take the worst part about, you know, Claudia Schiffer or whoever, and be like Angelina Jolie, like, wow, did you get stung by a bee or something? Because your lips look weird. What happened to your lips?
I wonder, you know, like, what Amazon's return policy is like. I got some books to send back.
Sorry about that, dude. Yeah. From what I understand, it works. But that whole idea of preying on other people to manipulate them to get such a some end, it just feels smarmy to me.
Yeah. Equally smarmy, or maybe not as bad as telling Angelina Jolie that her lips look like they got stung. But the direct auto direct mails when you follow someone on Twitter.
Oh yeah. Oh, thank you for following me. Right. If you ever need refinance mortgage advice, be sure to check out Tiny URL, or like this other deceptive service now, Edgix or something. Like, you, it's like a URL shortener, but when you click on it, you go to a website and it puts an ad at the top of the website in a frame, and you're like, oh, thanks.
And
the people using the service get to, it goes back to the Total News. Since I'm on a phone with a bunch of lawyers, remember Total News and the whole framing lawsuit?
Yeah, I was just thinking of that.
Still, I know that's exactly where your mind goes. Yeah. It's like, me too. I think like a lawyer too, but it's like, what is that, interfering with somebody's ability to do commerce? Something like that?
Yeah.
Some statute about that or some issue.
So, yes. And there were some copyright and trademark issues in that too, yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah, you hate to see that happen. The interesting thing, though, is that comes into play too, is that, you know, the negative stuff makes good headlines and good sort of, again, a different kind of link baiting. You know, how you get people to read something that's interesting is to focus on the negative and hold it up and incite fear and FUD and everything else. And it seems to me that, you know, I mean, although this stuff certainly does happen, it doesn't seem to me, it seems to me that the good stuff gets lost in the shuffle. Like what you did in connection with your post, Jason, was have the hashtag empathy day on Twitter. And I went and checked on that, you know, what are we, over a month since you wrote this piece, just to see how much traction it got. Did you know there are over 96 pages of search results for that on Twitter?
Wow. I didn't, but I know that a lot of people got into it.
Yeah.
And it worked. I mean, I got so many nice things people wrote back to me, you know, and I was just like, wow, that's so nice, you know, like, okay. So that's what I mean by retraining ourselves.
Exactly.
What have we forgotten? You know, like when we meet each other and we greet each other and, you know, I might say, oh, hey, you look great, Denise, or oh, I love your shoes, or, you know, oh, you've lost weight, or oh, how's your family, blah, 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 whatever. You know, like there's some cordialness and there's some nicety that just being in the presence of another human being evokes, which online we don't naturally have it evoke. It'd be good if we evoked it, you know, like if, you know, we all got on the Skype call and it showed a picture of each other and, you know, I don't know, maybe there's a little bar there and we could move the dial back and forth and say, like, you know, the dial could move in 360 degrees around a circle, and you could move it to, you know, it's so great to see you, or, oh, I missed you, or whatever, and just some device for communicating emotion a little bit easier.
Automative positive reinforcements.
Well, I mean, just, you know, just some way for me to, like, the same way emoticons give a little indication, like if there was just a little bar, you know, like next to your name, and I was just like randomly could just give it a little stroke, and, well, maybe we should take the metaphor a different direction. Just something where I could just check off something and be like, hey, you know, I guess poke is like that a little bit, right?
It is, and like, people hate poke.
I know. Okay, I guess it's annoying. Maybe I forget my suggestion. But I don't know. I kind of like when I see people poke me. It's like, ah, that's cute, you know. Although when people poke me, I don't know who they are. I'm like, hey, why are you poking me?
Right.
If any of you ever want to send me money, I'll interpret that as like you saying that you like me. That's all good.
There you go. The tip jar.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we are going to work on getting some of these shows in the live Twit ecosystem. Not being in Petaluma, that's a little bit more difficult for me here, as you are, Jason, down in the hinterlands of Southern California. But we're working on it. We're going to try and do video Skype calls. So maybe in the future we'll be able to see each other and give each other little smiles
yeah.
as we do the show. So in a minute, I want to get to talking about how this translates out to your role as a manager of a site, Jason. But before we go there, I do want to, as long as we're on the topic of talking with people remotely, give a big thanks to one of our sponsors, which is GoToMeeting. This is something that I definitely want people to check out. You get a 30-day free trial if you go to gotomeeting.com/twill. And since we've had these folks as a sponsor for a while, and I haven't mentioned the pricing, I thought I'd do that this time around so people know what they're getting in for after their 30-day free trial. It's really actually quite reasonable. It's $49 a month or $460 a year for unlimited meetings. And one of the things I would find, I think, most useful about this in this economy in particular is the ability to go somewhere and do a presentation without actually having to get on a plane and go to a hotel. Because what you can do is once you've got someone on GoToMeeting with you and they're seeing your computer screen, they could easily, you know, if you're in your home office or your office in another state, they can easily put that screen up on a projected screen so everyone in the room could see, and you could give your presentation as though you were standing there in the room. They could hear your voice. Unfortunately, they couldn't see your happy smiling face and the fact that you've learned how not to stand at the podium and all that good stuff as a presenter, but they could definitely see your presentation and hear your voice, and it's the next best thing to being there. So definitely go check out gotomeeting.com/twill, do the 30-day trial, and sign up for this service because it's super useful, particularly if you're trying to watch costs, as we all are right now.
It works.
Are you a user, Jason?
Yeah, actually. I'll tell you when I used it about 100 times in 1 week.
Wow. So you're getting the most out of that flat monthly or yearly fee.
You know, I don't even know how much get paid for sometimes, but I during the TechCrunch 50 conference, I have to do interviews with people from around the world. That's when we use it. Boom. Just click, and all of a sudden we're sharing desktops and talking, and it works perfectly.
That's wonderful. And there is a there's a GoToMeeting corporate, too, which I'm sure Mahalo is probably on. I'm getting a little echo here.
I got a little echo, too.
Just started. Let's see. Somebody just muted, and it went away.
I just muted, so it must be me.
Okay.
Okay.
I think you fixed it. Thanks, Colette. So, Jason, as founder and CEO of Mahalo and of other sites and a whole web logging ecosystem prior to that, how do you deal with civility issues and community issues from the standpoint of the site manager?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have a zero tolerance. We've just launched a new community on Mahalo called Mahalo Answers, which is a community that, you know, sort of like Yahoo Answers, but it's got a monetary system in it, like a currency. But anyway, the issue of how to manage the community is actually really interesting. I believe in having moderation. And so we pay people like 10 bucks an hour and it's unlimited supply of, you know, really good college educated people who want to make an extra, you know, $1,000 a month working 100 hours in their spare time. And we hire these folks to go in the system. And if somebody is obnoxious or stupid when they're answering a question or, you know, making jokes about a person, like, why don't you look it up in Google? We delete the post. And then what happens is we have another group of people who are in the system, and they will go around and tell people when they're doing a good job answering questions and how they can make the question even better. And so if you do those two things in concert and you're living inside the system, you basically have a zero tolerance for people who are making noise or are there to disrupt. And then you positively reinforce and give direction to the rest of the people. Everything seems to go in the right direction. The problem is people have this bizarre desire for freedom of speech inside of communities. And they mix freedom of speech with freedom of harassing or freedom of to disturb. And that's really two different things. Yes, you have the freedom to go protest on the street. I have the freedom to not have you protesting in my living room or in my house. So you can protest outside my house, but I can close the door, close the curtains, and not have to deal with it. And that's how online communities should run. The problem is Web 2.0 people don't want to ever spend the money to actually moderate a community. And they couple that with, oh, well, everybody should be able to have their say, and you're being a censor if you don't let people, you know, say what they want to say. It's like, well, you can say whatever you want, but say it civilly. Make your point without calling the person idiot, you know. Is that so hard? I don't think so.
Right. What do you – that makes sense for lots and lots of communities, and I think – you know, if you're smart and you're going to have a whole lot of interaction going on under your umbrella, that it is probably the only way to go. Did you follow, though, something that happened, I'm thinking about a year ago now, on Twitter, where Twitter sort of had this legacy terms of service that it had borrowed from Flickr when it had first gotten started. No one had gone back and looked at it. And the community guidelines were very proactive and said, we're not going to tolerate certain kinds of comments and behavior, and we're going to remove posts, et cetera, et cetera. But it turned out that really wasn't what Twitter wanted to be doing. What Twitter wanted to be doing was letting sort of a free-for-all transpire. And so they changed their terms, and they had some upset users who didn't like that some hostile things were going on, but that was the decision they made, and they went forward. Do you think there's a difference based on what sort of discourse is going on?
Absolutely. I think there's platforms and there's communities. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, YouTube, is it a platform or is it a community? You know, Twitter, platform or community, Facebook platform, community, Mahalo Answers, your blog, a blog software company. And that sometimes, you know, things look like a community when they're in fact a platform. Sometimes platforms, you know, and so you have to really peel back the onion and figure out exactly what you're dealing with. You know, on your personal blog, you can do whatever you want, and it's obviously a community, and you should, have a certain tone. But should WordPress tell you, like, you can't have people cursing in your, you know, things, or you can't have people being obnoxious? What if it's a comedy thing, and, you know, it's like roasting people, and that's the whole point of the site? Well, then, you know, the platform company is telling you how to use its stuff. So I think Twitter believes it's a platform company, and, you know, you can do whatever you want within, you know, the law. There are laws about cyber stalking, I believe, and harassment.
Sure.
And people can get different forms filled out when they feel like they're being harassed, and there's a process for that. So Twitter can say, we're a platform, and if you're experiencing harassment, you know, here are the legal channels to go through, and show us the harassment and we'll review it. But we're not going to try to describe what harassment is or, you know, take it to another level. But, you know, somebody's got a smaller site, they could do that, you know.
Have you ever gotten pushback at Mahalo or any of your other sites you've been involved in from users who, you know, didn't like it when you terminated their account or asked them to alter their behavior?
Typically, the response when you ask people to alter their behavior is they blow a gasket, you know, oh my God, you're censoring me, blah, blah, blah. And you just state to them exactly the facts. And either they get it or they don't. And I would say most times they don't get it. And then you just very simply cancel their account, and then you watch their IP address, and if they sign up again, you let them try a second time. We actually see this all the time. People try a second time, and you know, a lot of times they'll come back again, and they'll behave themselves because they don't want to lose their account. Mm-hmm. But who cares? You know, like that's the way I feel about it. You know, like I tell people all the time on, you know, Mahalo Answers, or I told them on my blog, or I told them on with relation to TechCrunch 50, the event, you know, okay, you don't like the way we're doing it. I understand that, but it's our event, or it's our website, or it's our blog. We're going to run it the way we want to. But the good news is you can make your own. And so, you know, when you have that argument with people, they're like, well, I'm going to. And you're like, awesome. I will totally check it out when you do. And, you know, that's what I tell people with, you know, they have problems with TechCrunch 50. And they're like, oh, you know, you didn't let this company in because we want all the companies at the event to launch at the event. Oh, you know, you didn't let this event in. You should have let this company in, or you should give people 15 minutes or whatever. Everybody's got their opinion. And I say, you know what? That's great. We've heard that argument from, you know, a couple of dozen people, actually, and majority of them, or, it's, you know, I tell people it's a jump ball. You know, 60% of people think the way you think, and 40% think the other way. It's not a clear answer. And so we're going to go with what works for us.
Jason, where do you draw the line, or what kind of decision-making process do you go through to separate legitimate feedback from, you know, criticism that you want to dismiss?
Yeah, it's good thing about that. I think, you know, a lot of times the people who have the worst things to say sometimes have also the most insightful things to say. So I tend to look for, I try to erase in my mind the flaming part of the email, or the flaming part of the comment, and try to cut that out and then just look for the point. And I had this happening the other night. Somebody was upset about something and I just said, what would you like me to do? You know, because in the email, there was none of that. There was just, you know, like, oh, this is wrong, and this is wrong, and this is wrong, and users are gonna leave because of it, and this is unfair. And I just said, I totally, you know, and when I tried to debate those issues, it just made it worse. So I just said, finally, what do you want me to do? You know, like, tell me. And then they had a couple of suggestions. You know, out of the 6 or 7 suggestions, I say one or two were very practical, good suggestions. The other ones were jump balls, and maybe one or two of them were wacky, which is probably better than my ratio of ideas, right, to be honest. So, you know, I think you just have to take the tone down and just say, you know, what's at the heart of the matter? And if there's irreconcilable differences, you know, then you just have to be in a different situation. It's like being married, right? Or something like, some people are religious, some people are atheists. Some people are tolerant atheists, some people are tolerant religious people. And then some people aren't. There are some people who are atheists who say, I can't possibly be married to somebody who believes in God, they're idiots. And then somebody who believes in God is totally intolerant of somebody who's an atheist. Oh, you're going to go to hell. And they shouldn't be together, you know?
Yeah.
And the good news is they don't need to.
Empathy is a good rule of thumb.
I agree. Get to what's wrong here? What do you want? What's the goal here? You know, and right. I find that a lot of the people who make the most noise are the ones who have the least solutions. So that's the more noise you'll make and the more you'll complain, the least likely you are to actually come up with a good solution. In the
right. That's what I was thinking about when you were talking about people getting all First Amendment on you, so to speak. It's an irony, or it's kind of a paradox to see that those who are always complaining about their First Amendment rights being violated really have the least valuable things to say.
Yeah.
And, you know, the people who are really saying things that are important and that are helpful and that tend to really, you know, move us along in a progressive way are the ones that you don't complain about their First Amendment rights. But maybe that's presupposing some certain things, because those are the ones who aren't going to be criticized or tried to be squelched in the first place. I don't know.
There's a great quote that I always love and I always come back to by George Bernard Shaw. And he says, the reasonable man adapts himself to the world. The unreasonable one persists in trying to adapt the world to himself. Therefore, all progress depends on the unreasonable man. And I think that it hits home, because, you know, we talk about the internet changing the way that discourse takes place. And to some extent, we say, well, we hope it gets better. But there have always been unreasonable people. And unreasonable people, you know, you do have to wait for them to accomplish certain things, because we live in a democracy and everybody has a voice. But Yet you have to moderate the debate so that meaningful information gets exchanged and isn't squelched by those who would grab the bullhorn and drown out everybody else. And you know, at the core, the really extreme examples that we're talking about, these are unreasonable people, and they're not really interested in having a debate. They're just interested in forcing their viewpoint on other people.
I felt like that was an Apple commercial or something running through my head when you, here's to the unreasonable ones. The ones who insist on not having a right mouse button key. The ones who refuse to put cut and paste into an iPhone.
Yeah, but not after today, right?
That's right.
Exactly. Well, yeah, Steve Jobs takes a break and all of a sudden the cut and paste works and all of a sudden you can turn your keyboard sideways. Okay,
boy, those guys are going to catch hell when he finds out what they did
today.
When
he comes back and he finds out you're in trouble. That'd be great. Can you imagine if in the 4.0 of the software, they're like, and he gets on stage and he's like, and we have a new feature. We've removed cut and paste. Also, now your keyboard is limited in email to being only in the upright position. Thank you. I'm Steve Jobs. Oh, that'd be great. You should do that as a joke. Can you imagine if Steve Jobs did his return on April 1st and then went through and reversed like all of these things?
There you go. Get Kevin Pollak to do an imitation on his show.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God. That'd be so funny.
Yes, I am looking forward to that. Have they already rolled out the update, or is that yet
to come?
It's
not until June.
Ah.
Well, this is a big mistake. So now Steve Jobs always had the rule, like, don't talk about stuff that you can't download or buy today. And now they're going to change that? That's not a good idea.
Haven't they done that with most of the updates, though? They mention them either at Macworld and then release them later, or they announced the iPhone months before it was available.
That's true. Worked us all into a froth.
Yeah. Yeah. Good Lord. That was a big day, wasn't it?
So one other sponsor I want to thank, and I thought long and hard about a good recommendation for our Audible pick this week, given the tone of what we're talking about and the folks that we had on and the fact that, Jason, I know you're a big fan of Audible.com.
Audible.
The thing that I picked is, you know, I think we're talking about this tension between the fact that we all sort of like things to be peaceful and managed, but yet the upstart definitely has its role. And as Ernie pointed out in that great quote, you know, it may be the seat of all of our forward motion as a society. So the theme that brings to mind is something that's in Stephanie Meyer's The Host. This is the book she wrote after the Twilight saga that was so popular and resulted in Twilight the movie, etc. The Host is like this classic science fiction work of, you know, the alien comes and takes over your brain, except for they do that to everyone on the planet. And most people are completely subsumed by that. But every now and then, the one strong, forceful personality is able to interject themselves and sort of coexist with the alien. And so that's what this story is about. It reminds me a lot, actually, of are you guys watching Dollhouse on Fox? The TV show?
Not yet.
Oh my goodness, you need to check this out. This is a really, really good TV series, and it stars Elisha Dushku, if I'm saying her name properly, probably not, who was on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and it, just a great, great drama show. And the concept there is that they have this this group of humans that they are keeping, and they have technology that imprints them with different personalities, and then they go out on missions and they come back. And when they're back, they're in this passive, peaceful, tranquil state, and they're beautifully maintained in this facility, and they don't really, you know, have much of a sense of identity. They're all on, you know, mega doses of Prozac, basically. And then they go off on their missions. But of course, there's the one played by Elisha Dushku, who is beginning to sense that there's something else going on and interjecting her own personality. And so that's sort of what's going on here in The Host. And I'm going to try and play a sample of this so that people can get a taste of it.
At the word seeker, Fords gave Darren a look that could only be described as a glare. Darren blinked in shock. I'm sorry. Fords apologized at once. I didn't mean to react so negatively. It's just that I fear for this soul. His eyes moved to the cryo tank on its stand beside the table. The light was a steady, dull red, indicating that it was occupied and in hibernation mode.
So it's read by Kate Reading, and she does a really good dramatic job of it. And
her name is Reading?
Reading. Kate Reading is the reader. Maybe it's Reading, but it's spelled R-E-A-D. So go to audiblepodcast.com/twill, and The Host by Stephanie Meyer can be yours, along with a free trial to a gold membership to Audible, which I'm sure you will enjoy. So thank you, Audible. We love you.
I love Audible. I just want to say that, put it out there.
Thank you so much, Jason. Jason, the next question I wanted to get to that flows from what we're talking about in managing your community is having terms of service that your community can live with, and how you, as the CEO and founder of a site with terms of service, approach that problem. And since you're very good at giving advice to other businesses based on your lengthy tenure in the internet industry, I'm wondering what advice you would give to people to avoid the Facebook terms of service problem.
I think, you know, as you get bigger, the scrutiny on it obviously gets greater. So, you know, most services don't have to worry about this, to be honest. They should write a good one. I'm not saying they shouldn't, but it's usually when they get bigger that they have a problem. And usually when people have a problem is when they get, what's the word, cute, you know, like a little too overreaching. And so if you look at Facebook, they had, I think, an argument that it goes against the core of what everybody's belief is about copyright, which is like, I took this photo and I own it, or I wrote these words and I own it. And Zuckerberg, who is a young guy and, you know, doesn't have a lot of experience, which is probably why he was able to do some great things, you know, thought, oh, because you put that image in my system and that image was on other people's pages, it was published to their pages, that's how it works. And the people who had your content syndicated to their pages, they're the priority over you, which is a very, I would say, immature technologist kind of worldview. And I don't know if he wrote it himself, and I'm not saying he's an immature technologist, but that's what that worldview says to me. Like, oh, the technology enabled this, therefore it's right. You know, it's a sort of techno ultimatum, you know, like, or, you know, technology allows it, therefore it's possible. It's the same thing with the Napster kids when they came out. They were like, oh, well, you know, I have MP3s, you have MP3s, we can connect our computers. What's illegal about it? It's possible. You know, it's like, well, okay, there's the law, and then there's what's possible, and there's what's right, and then there's what's possible. And I think that's where people get screwed up, is they think because, you know, they've got some technical reason to do something that trumps the actual fairness of the situation. So I always try to go back to fair as my benchmark. Forget about law. Forget about, you know, what technology is capable of, because those two things are at opposite sides of the spectrum. Obviously, the law is, is decades old, and technology is very forward-looking. So that's why they typically don't mix well, oil and vinegar, whatever. But fair is fair. I think fair stays the same no matter how time changes. And fairness would state, it's your picture. If you want to take it down, even if it screws up somebody else's experience a little bit, it's your picture. And if they're comment on your picture, if they want to take it down, they can, even if it screws up the flow of your comments on your site, with, you know, very rare exceptions, like when you give a license to somebody. They just went too far, you know. It's just so obvious. So, I mean, read it. Have your lawyers give it to you in bullet points. I like to write the terms of service myself in bullet points in plain English. You give us, you know, a license to your answers so that we can have it on our website. You own those answers and you can do whatever you want with them. We can, however, sell our company and the answers go with it. You can, you know, take down your answers if you like, you know, something like that, you know, whatever it is. But you can't take down your questions, because if 20 people answer the question and the question is 140 characters, we don't want you to be able to take that down, because then you know, people are answering and the question doesn't make any sense. And there's no real harm to you ask the question, like, what's the best pizzeria in San Francisco? We can take your name off of it. How about that? You know, so if you think about it like that, you know, you generally get to the right conclusion.
Right. I think that's a real important takeaway, because I think what too many sites and too many folks who are managing sites might fall into the trap of doing is going to their lawyers and saying, you know, okay, we're at this point where we're going to launch and we need some terms of service. We know we need that. Give us something and we'll put it up, as opposed to sitting down with them and really doing the bullet points in plain English and having a clear understanding of, you know, what the community expectations are and how they should fit in with what the site needs. That was sort of our theory here on Twill, is that somebody at Facebook was not minding the lawyers sufficiently when they came out with the language that got them into so much recent trouble.
People don't like, you know, doing this kind of work with lawyers in general. You know, if you're a CEO type, it's like, ah, legal details, fuck it. Sorry.
It's okay.
It's like, ah, frack it. I'm not interested. You know, like, just get, let the lawyers do it. And then lawyers have left in this terrible position of like, okay, we have no direction and we're going to make the business decisions for Mark Zuckerberg. You know, it's like, this is a little bit of responsibility to make decisions for the $15 billion market cap company or whatever, you know, is supposed to be worth. I always like to take a little more ownership of it and actually write the bullet points down.
Just go ahead, Colette.
What's interesting to me is that it's not just the lawyers and the CEO or business execs, it's the marketing people who, and the whoever's running the community aspect, if the site has, you know, kind of a separated community aspect to it, because you really have to understand whose feathers you're going to ruffle when you update terms. And I think that's an important piece, that it's just as much a marketing or PR issue as it is a lawyer and, you know, the finance or business folks side too. But I think that's what one of the things that Facebook did wrong with Beacon initially, and now very recently with their privacy policy changes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you're not paying attention to what the fallout's going to be, Mashable just did a great post on this. I thought it was the five things you should know to basically not, I forget what the title was, but five things you should know to not stick your foot in it on the internet. And I think every lawyer should read that so that they're cognizant of what they might be telling their clients to do.
Yeah. They, you have very disparate groups of people who think very differently, who work very differently. You know, lawyers are, you know, want stuff on paper and they have to put it into language that, you know, stands up to scrutiny. And, you know, entrepreneurs, like, they just say something off the top of their head, you know, while eating ice cream and see it turned into a product, and the marketing people want to, you know, puff it up and make it into something that's 300% more than what the CEO originally intended. And, you know, you got all these different forces pulling things and warping them, you know, into different manifestations of what they really are. And that, you know, the terms of service is actually where the rubber hits the road. People should sit in the same room or just, you know, discuss it and, you know, start with some bullet points, pass them to the next person, turn them into language, read the language out loud. I like to read the language out loud. That's another thing I do, just to, you know, I was going to say screw with people, but I do it to screw with people sometimes too, is I just take the language they wrote and I read it out loud. Because nobody does that, you know? Like, imagine reading a terms of service out loud.
The party of the first part, yeah.
I mean, it's like, I'm like, okay, my mom is going to hit the agree key. And, you know, like, just try to say it in a little bit more plain English. I like this thing where people say it in plain English and then have the legalese below it.
Mm-hmm.
That's becoming
I think that's a great way to get sued, you know? I mean, because I think just like anything else, there's got to be some moderation here. I mean, there's a certain appeal to having things in plain English, and there's a certain appeal to having things, you know, said in legalese and then with the bullet points up, you know, to the side. But, man, you're just really inviting, you know, some ambiguity. And you know, I think if – which are you going to, you know, be bound by? So I would just caution, you know, everybody that's listening to this and everybody on the call. I mean, just have some moderation here. Contract language is important because it requires precision. And, you know, CEOs the business people, you know, want something to stand up to scrutiny just as much as what the lawyers do. So, you know, it's just, it's really easy to, you know, be, you know, lackadaisical about this stuff, but that doesn't obscure the fact that, that the terms are there to serve a purpose and they should serve it well.
Right. But you're not saying, Evan, that plain English isn't susceptible of carrying precise meaning, are you?
Oh, of course not.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, because I agree that you shouldn't, you know, if you're going to speak in one language, you shouldn't, you know, translate to another, because that just creates the opportunity for somebody to say, well, that was a mistranslation. But I'm a huge proponent of drafting agreements in language that, you know, everybody can understand. And I think that's a huge problem that the legal profession has. And you know, people defend it who don't even understand the rationale behind it, and because, you know, they don't understand what they're even trying to accomplish. I mean, there's a lot of lawyers who think that if they just put, you know, a lot of paragraphs that, you know, numbered 1.3.4 sub whatever that looks like the Code of Federal Regulations, that they've accomplished something really worthwhile, when in fact it makes it really hard to read. You know, I mean, to me, a contract is like a computer program. You should be able to read it and kind of jump around and see what things relate to one another. And computer programs are a great example. I mean, here's a complex series of instructions, but the best coders are the ones who are able to describe clearly what they're doing at all times, so anybody can jump in and understand. And let me tell you, there are a lot of contracts that I don't understand when I read them. I mean, they just, I don't know who got together to write them, but they're just bunk. And I think that that's something that the legal profession seriously needs to face. I know that Brian Garner has taken that task on, along with Justice Scalia, and I wish him the best of luck, because there's a serious reform movement that needs to complete. It's, I know it's started, but it hasn't gotten very far, in my opinion, in the legal profession, to make things, you know, to use everyday language.
Yeah, I'm with you, Ernie. And I love Jason's idea of reading the language out loud to the lawyers and holding them up to scorn and ridicule if it's not clear.
Abraham Lincoln was in the habit of reading things out loud. And he said, you know, so that he could do that, or he did that so that he could, you know, see it and hear it. So, you know, yeah. There's something certainly to be said about that.
The other thing, although it does sort of bring in that wild card of potential ambiguity that you were warning of, Evan, I do like what Creative Commons does with its Creative Commons deeds in language that anybody's mother could understand, and then the full legal document. I know there's a danger to doing it that way, but I think when you're dealing with things that are going to be, you know, read by people who are not lawyers and that are going to have an impact on their life, you almost owe it to them to have that explanation in understandable terms.
And you can rest assured that that when they decide to sue you, they'll sue you under the version that they like better.
Yeah, you know? That's true.
So
you better, I guess the upshot is you got to make sure that you're good with both of them.
Right. And I'm overstating it, you know, of course, but you know, the point being that there's, you know, precision is key, and you know, there's nothing that should be sacrificed by saying things clear. It's just that you can't overdo it in, you know, trying to be too trendy and too hipster like, you know.
Yeah,
I think a good example of the summary versus the full legal code version is also the Google policies. I think they have, and maybe an older version, but I think the eBay policies also, they have a summary of their privacy policies, for example, followed by, you know, links to every part of the policy that's relevant for their summary. And I think for users, it's actually very effective, because the point of a privacy policy, for example, is to put everyone on notice of what you're doing with their personally identifiable information. And to, you know, on a sort of the more business side, you know, give people a clear understanding of what you're doing so that you can go forward and do it without worrying that they're going to be able to argue your misuse of their personally identifiable information. So I don't know. I think some companies have really bridged that gap well, having both versions. But I do think that Evan's got a point. You have to be cautious about how you do that.
Yeah. Hey, folks, I've got a wrap. Thank you so much all for being here today. Jason, I'm looking forward to This Week in Startups.
It should be fun.
Yeah, that's going to be cool. That's going to be using your new TriCaster. Is that right? Did we just lose Jason? I hope not. Did we just lose everybody? No, you're all there. No, we lost Jason. Okay. Goodbye, Jason. We were wrapping anyway. I will plug This Week in Startups, which I believe is going to be a new video show, as I was trying to pin down, from Jason Calacanis, who you can find at calacanis.com and twitter.com/JasonCalacanis. And check out at Answers and at Questions on Twitter, too. Those are new services from Mahalo that look really interesting and useful as far as tossing out questions you might have and getting back useful answers and information. Ernie, great to have you back on the show. Thank you so much for your input.
Sure. Great to be here, as always.
And folks can find Ernie at ErnieTheAttorney.net and Twitter.com/ErnieAttorney. Colette, great to have you back, too. Really excited about all the stuff that you're doing these days and all the great stuff you've been twittering my way. Thanks. Keep it up.
Welcome. It's been fun.
Yeah. And folks can find Colette at vogellaw.com, VogelElaw.com, and at twitter.com/Colette, Colette, and twitter.com/vogellaw. And Evan, we can track down at internetcases.com and twitter.com/internetcases.
That's me.
Thank you so much, Evan. Folks can find me at imetdenise.com. All my stuff and links are there, as well as twitter.com/dhowell. Thanks so much for joining us again for Twill. We'll talk with you again soon. Bye, folks. Jason? Jason, you there? You look like you're there, but I can't hear you. Jason? Jason? Oh, Jason. Not sure what's going on there, but I'll try you back, okay?
Can you hear me now?
I can. It's a magical thing.
Wow. Sorry about being late. I just, my meeting showed up late and I didn't push back. Thank you. Oh, there you go. You're back.
Yeah, I'm back. I'm trying to add you to our conference call, which Skype, in its eminent wisdom, sometimes doesn't let me do unless I have initiated the call.
Oh, I'll hang up.
Okay, thanks. I'll call you right back. Jason. Jason. Oh, Jason. Why is this happening? Okay, Jason, I'm going to try it one more time here.
Rocking.
You're there, and Jason's there, and it won't put the two of you together.
Well, of the two of us, I'd say he's more important.
I don't know about that, but I want you both.
That's so weird.